Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. It's really nice to have you here. We're in Zechariah chapter 14. We're going to look at verses 1 through 5, but we're also going to overlap that with what we didn't get done with last week. What we tried to do last week is try to look at all the descriptions that are provided for possibly the last battle. The battle of Gog and Magog, I'm going to set that aside. I don't think that's the same battle we're talking about here, although of course it could be. What we seem to be having taking place right here is we've got the Dead Sea, the Jordan River, the Valley of Armageddon or Jezreel Valley here. The gathering of the nations are going to take place here. Here's Jerusalem. And then in Edom, Bozra, the Lord is going to appear in Bozra. Now, when and how this happens, you know, we've got to draw up, and I have presented some things, not that it's absolute, but we've got several verses coming together. Jesus and Daniel tell the Jews that they will, when they see the abomination in halfway through the tribulation, through the 70th week, to flee to the mountains. Revelation talks about a place that he's prepared for them in the desert. That would seem to be in this area of, in Edom, in near Bozra, which is near Petra, a great place to hide. And Jesus is definitely in Isaiah 63 coming back here, or at least he's going to appear there. And he's going to have a battle there. When he leaves, his garment is going to be splattered with blood. So, and it's clearly he's fought a battle. And he talks about having fought against the nations and that no one was with him, no one helped him. Now, when he says no one was there to help him, that is the indication. When it came time to vote on whose side you're on, the Antichrist or the Messiah's, the nations voted for the Antichrist. And so there were it wasn't Jesus and an alignment of nations. It was just Jesus alone. And the nations have arrived here. Now, they've assembled here. Their goal is to march on Jerusalem. And it seems like they've continued now down to Edom because they're getting the Jews there. Without jumping too far into the book of Revelation, it does talk about Satan sending water, trying to flood them, destroy them, but the earth opens its mouth and absorbs the water or diverts the water. But Satan is trying to get to these Jews that are in hiding down here. They're being protected supernaturally, normally. It appears Ammon, Moab, and Edom will not fall to the Antichrist. That it says that fairly clearly, which that would be the land of Jordan at this time. Now, Zechariah 12 presents, I think, also the same battle. And again, I'm putting these things together as we're going. And as we went through Zechariah chapter 12, we remember that there was three groups of people, or Jews, that were fighting. They were being attacked. In fact, if you don't mind, look at chapter 12 and look how familiar this would sound to our theme tonight. I will point out there at the very chapter 12, verse 1, it begins in the NIV, an oracle, and that is the word that we're going to look at later. That is the word masa, which means an oracle, a prophecy. This is the word of the Lord concerning Israel, the Lord who stretches out the heavens, who lays the foundation of the earth, and who forms the spirit of man within him. Declares. And now in verse 2, I am going to make Jerusalem a cup that sends all the surrounding peoples reeling. If you look on page 2 of your notes, I've got those two verses put out there in Hebrew. I'm going to refer to them later. But you got to look at them backwards, you know, read them backwards. But page 2 at the top, there's the chapter 12, verse 1. The first word is masa, which means the burden or the oracle or the prophetic announcement, which sums up chapter 12, 13, and 14. It's a group of information. It's an oracle. It's a burden laid on Zechariah. And then in chapter 12, verse 2, the very next word, you see there's the word, it's not translated in the NIV. You'll see it in the English Standard Version. The word behold. I've got it in a box and it's underlined. That is, behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the people surrounding. And when against Judah they lay siege upon Jerusalem. Again, notice that word, behold. And that's like, take a look or pay attention. That is, if you go back to page 1, Zechariah chapter 14, verse 1, which we'll read in just a moment. In the English Standard, it begins, "Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst." That same word begins, if you look in the Hebrew, it's in a box again, Hinna, H-I-N-N-E-H. So chapter 12, verse 2, and chapter 14, verse 1, both begin with this, "Behold, behold," meaning he's making a pronouncement, "Look at this, look at this," and it's the same oracle, it's the same prophecy, the same collection, so there's probably an overlap, but nonetheless, the point of that is in chapter 12, God is saying already, you're not going to be able to move Jerusalem, and all the nations are going to come, and they're going to hurt themselves. And as you go through there, you're going to see, it talks about the tents of Judah, or the people of Judah, dividing them from the inhabitants of Jerusalem, dividing them from the people of David, or the tribe of David. There's three groups fighting here. It's possible, when we look down here, that may be referring to one of these groups down here, because Judah is going to begin to fight in chapter 14. Here we see the people fighting without the Lord in chapter 12, and then the Lord suddenly appears, and they see him, and they mourn for the one that they pierced, and he shows up for their deliverance here. Now, in chapter 14, let's begin to read chapter 14, verse 1. I'm looking, first of all, in the NIV. In fact, I'm going to read through chapter 14 in the NIV, at least a lot of it. I will point this out as you look on page 1 again, the general overview of what we'll look at tonight. Chapter 14, verse 1 and 2, the nations are brought against Jerusalem. They're gathered here. We read that in Revelation. They're gathered here, but they're also gathered to come against Jerusalem, and God is bringing them. It appears it's some form of discipline, that because the craziness of what's going to happen. The city's going to be overrun, houses ransacked, women are raped. It's a judgment scene. It's what takes place when Babylon falls. It's described that way. It's what Jeremiah says is going to happen to Jerusalem when Babylon comes in and destroys it. So it is a scene of discipline. It's just that halfway through, things change. This could go back to that, the two-thirds and the one-third. Of two-thirds are going to be destroyed, a third is going to be spared. We've got that in this book of Zechariah also. But nonetheless, the first two verses, 1 and 2, the nations are brought against Jerusalem, and the nations are successful. The campaign of Armageddon to destroy Jerusalem, and it would appear, we see in Revelation, it's demonic spirits coming out from the dragon Satan, from the false prophet and the Antichrist. They're demons going out to gather the kings. If we put this in some kind of a situation, they've probably decided it is important to eliminate this group of people because they're holding to an ideology that is contrary to what the mark of the beast represents, or what the Antichrist wants, or what the image that they set up in the temple begins to talk, it comes alive and tells them, we need to eliminate these people that will not receive the mark. And that would seem to be a removal of an ideology that is contrary to, you know, the current artificial intelligence or whatever is happening here. And they're marching on Jerusalem, and there is the city begins to fall. Looks like some kind of discipline. And that's chapter 1 and 2. Then in chapter 14, verse 3, Yahweh goes out to fight against those nations. Now, again, in my mind, I want him coming down on the Mount of Olives from heaven, you know, the second coming, which may be. But also, if he's already come down and delivered these people in Edom, he's leading them. Now, again, he could lead them right back up this way, or like last week, I had the map going up here through Jericho like this. He's leading and coming up here with this ones he delivered. He's already slaughtered the nations because the nations have come here. We're going to see they're winning this battle, and they've marched right on past, leaving a remnant behind to finish up the city. They've already started exiling people. They're being sent off into slavery, and there will be slavery in the tribulation, or the 70th week. It talks about that in Revelation. There's slavery today. No one wants to talk about it, but there's slavery in the world today. There always has been slavery. But they're exiling these people probably into slavery. And the nations apparently have gone down to pursue the Jews that are hiding in Edom, where the Lord apparently is going to come back. He defeats them, his garment splattered with blood, and he marches up, leading with him those that he delivered, which could be a reference to the tents of Judah, who are delivered first. And they come in here and they march in over the Mount of Olives, and that's what's taking place here. So I would say, suggesting at least, and you know, it's obviously it's eschatology, it needs to be debated and moved around so we have the right sequence. But chapter 14, verse 3 would be Yahweh showing up here, and he goes out to fight in the day of battle and changes the direction of this battle. And chapter 14, verse 4 and 5, and I will show you also 14, verses 12 through 15. So 4 and 5 and verses 12 through 15 are the details of the battle. Between those verses, it stops and begins to describe the events of what transpires because of the Lord's intervention. It starts to describe the millennial kingdom, or the seasons, or what's going to take place. And after a few verses, between 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, it goes back and gives some details of what the Lord did during this battle. So this chapter is going to talk about the battle, but also you can see it breaks off and describes certain events taking place there. But you will see the battle that we're talking about here in verses 4 and 5 and 12 through 15, where the Lord is intervening and they are winning the battle. So with that introduction, look at 14:14, those living outside Jerusalem. 14:14 clearly says, especially in the English Standard, I'm looking at ahead in chapter 14 of Zechariah, verse 14, it just sticks in there. Judah too will fight at Jerusalem. And they are identified in chapter 12 of the house of David or Judah. The wealth of the surrounding nations will be collected, great quantities of gold and silver and clothing. Anyway, that's an insert there. We'll come back to it. So anyway, let's go to chapter 14, verse 1 in the NIV. A day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided among you. Without getting too far distracted, notice the word behold is also missing there. I think that's a marker in this prophecy. Chapter 12, verse 2, behold, and begins to describe the event. And then chapter 14, verse 1, you can see it right there on page 1, hinna, which means behold or take note, here's some more details. And so take note or behold, a day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided among you. And that would be discipline. Chapter 14, verse 2, I will gather all nations to Jerusalem. Revelation, they're gathered in Armageddon to be brought against Jerusalem, which is chapter 12, an immovable stone that God is bringing the nations against to punish the nations. But it appears first he's going to punish the Jews and bring them back to the place where they're going to recognize his messiahship, and then he's going to come and deliver them. So all these are possibly fitting together. We got all the nations being gathered by the Lord, all nations are coming to Jerusalem, and God guaranteeing, I'm going to use Jerusalem to punish the nations. I will gather all nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. This is sad right here. This is not what you want to read, because you want to read about the Lord coming back and delivering the Jews. But all the nations are at Jerusalem to fight against it. Apparently it's Armageddon, or the campaign of Armageddon. The city will be captured. Oh no, I mean they break through the walls or whatever. They're in control of the city. The house is ransacked. They've gone in and they begin to plunder the houses, take the possessions, and the women raped. So the city has fallen. Now not everybody, because we're going to read about half the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. So what's going to happen? Why are they not going to be taken from the city? You go back to chapter 12. There's going to be some fighting coming back, and there's going to be some pushback and some victories. Here, it's going to tell you what takes place. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations. The rest will not go into exile, or will not be taken from the city, or the word, we'll see it, is cut off. They will not be killed. Then the Lord, and notice in the NIV, it's all four letters are capital, so that means then Yahweh will go out and fight against those nations. So they've been gathered here by the demons, the three demons that have gone out. They've been brought down here by the Lord to attack Jerusalem, and now the Lord goes out to fight against those nations. If they have begun the battle and been successful and have sent some troops down here, or some nations have gone down here, again, the Lord's going to destroy the nations down here already. His garments are splattered with blood, and now he's coming up here and entering the city. He's going to bring the battle back up here. They met here and came down to get his people. He came here, delivered these people, comes up and intervenes in this battle. That's, again, the way I'm presenting it. Does that make sense? That you don't have to say, I don't know if that makes sense. I don't know if it does either. I'm just trying to put these verses together. As soon as it doesn't fit, we move the chart. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. Now again, I want that to be the image, the second coming. He splits the sky and floats down and lands on the Mount of Olives. But that's not exactly what it says. That would be an assumption. See, I'm reading that into the text. This would be the same thing. He marches from Edom, either up from this direction or around this way, and comes over. And that's important. I'm going to show you in these verses, because that's exactly the reverse of what happened when he leaves the temple in Ezekiel. The glory of the Lord departed this way and goes over to Babylon. This time, he's coming back from the east, and that's exactly the way he came in on the triumphal procession. He came from, we're talking about that in Mark. He's going to come from Jericho, and then for the final week, arrive on the Palm Sunday, and then come into the temple. Zechariah talks about your king, your Messiah, coming riding on a donkey. Jesus fulfilled that. So he leaves this way in Ezekiel, the glory leaves. In his ministry, he comes in this way to be crucified, and now he's going to come in again from this way. There you have it. East of Jerusalem, the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west. Now, and this is like the parting of the Red Sea, because these people that are left in the city, they're still under siege. The city has fallen to the nations. They just haven't gotten all the way through the city. We have a similar situation in 69-70 AD when Rome broke in from the north through the north walls. There's three walls. Herod Agrippa had started a third wall and it had been finished by the rebels. I could talk about that. But the Romans first broke through that wall only to find that there was a second wall from earlier. Well, the city fell. I mean, it's been surrounded for months. They're starving, but they're still not taken. They break through the first wall. Then they have to battle in to get through the second wall. They're trying to get to Fort Antonia, where they have access to the Temple Mount. So the Jews are just being pushed back further and further into the city. So once the wall is broken, they're in the city, but you've got to go through another wall to get through deeper in the city. And then you've got to get into the fortress. Meanwhile, the Jews are still staging battles. They're not just sitting in their houses going, we're dead. They're out, digging tunnels underneath the siege equipment so it falls in and burns up, all kinds of things. It takes them, again, 4 years. It takes the Romans 4 years to have Jerusalem fall. And like I said, I don't know if it was Sunday or Tuesday, Jerusalem fell in 70 AD and the Jews are done. But by 133 AD, they have rebuilt, regrouped, re-weaponized, and they started another revolt against Rome called the Bar Kokhba Revolt. And Hadrian has come in and spend 2 years, 133 to 135, putting down the second Jewish revolt. Now imagine a people being totally destroyed and then coming back 60 years later, fully armed, and then during this war, wiping out an entire legion of Roman soldiers. And that's why Hadrian says no more, plowed the place, renamed it Aliyah, capped Aliyah, and renamed the land of Israel Palestine, or we call it Palestinians, or he named it Philistines, but nonetheless. So there'd be this battle. So the people that are in here fighting, the Lord comes back to deliver them. Oh, my point. It's always nice to know where you're heading with this. Half the mountain moving north and half moving south. The Mount of Olives will be split this way. And these people are under siege. They're going to need a place to flee. It's very, in my mind, again, I didn't read this in a commentary, but it's very similar to Moses parting the Red Sea and the Israelites going across, or What's interesting also is when they came through the Jordan with Jericho, or Joshua leading them into, across the Jordan to take Jericho, the priest with the Ark of the Covenant, Moses held up his arms, his staff, to part the Red Sea. But when they crossed the Jordan, they took the Ark of the Covenant, and the priest had to step down into the water with the Ark of the Covenant, and then the water stopped flowing way up at a city called Adam, you know, up in this place up in here. It stopped flowing, and the people went across. That's what's going to take place here. When Jesus stands on the Mount of Olives, it's going to split. It's going to move. Now again, this is the topography change that is typical of Revelation talks about this. Earthquakes, lightning, things going flat, mountains falling, islands disappearing. We could tie this all together at this moment. It's a typical theophany where the Lord intervenes in history, or what we'd say a divine warrior appearing and these things taking place. Mount Sinai saw it. But when Jesus steps his feet on the Mount of Olives, it splits, either because of an earthquake, because of his presence, whatever. But that splitting is not just, oh, that was cool. It's a way for the people to escape from the nations that are trying to finish off the city. They've held their own. They can flee. And then the Lord and the tribe of Judah will finish off the nations. The Lord is fighting, but Judah in chapter 12, and in chapter 14, the Jews are fighting with him in these final moments. Now, how that all looks, we just kind of keep building on it. Okay, with half the mountain moving north, half moving south, verse 5, you will flee by my mountain valley, for it will extend to Azel, or Azel. And that's a place no one knows where that's at. I'm getting ahead of myself, but it's a location that hasn't been identified. You will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah. And Amos mentioned that. That's how the book started. Amos was it the second year after the earthquake? In the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. Now these holy ones, you've got three choices. The holy ones, clearly angels. The holy ones are clearly the saints, the holy ones who are coming with him. Where is he coming from? He's coming from Bozra, Edom, and the holy ones that are coming with him are those that have been protected that are coming back with him in this. So again, are angels with him, I'm sure. Are the believers, the saints, they've returned, or they're somewhere. But here also, you've got these that he's delivered. He's not just walking up here by himself. He's leading this progression, leading them back into Jerusalem. Again, we leave it right there. What are the holy ones? It could be all three. One of them, would pick your choice, depending on probably the context and who is being referred to. Verse 6, now that's the end of the battle description there. Now just some details. On that day, there will be no light, no cold or frost. It will be a unique day, obviously, without daytime or nighttime. Does that mean the sun's going to stand still like it did for Joshua? A day known to the Lord. When evening comes, there will be light. So maybe this day just doesn't stop until his enemies are defeated, kind of like Joshua, the sun didn't set. I'm just reading through it. On that day, living water will flow out of Jerusalem. See, we're way, I don't want to say off subject, but we're not done with the battle yet. But on that day, water's going to come out of Jerusalem, and now we're into Ezekiel. That's where you're going to have water flowing into both the seas. Will flow out of Jerusalem, half to the Eastern Sea, that's the Dead Sea, and half to the Western Sea, that's the Mediterranean Sea, in the summer and winter. So you see, when we're talking about summer and winter, we're clearly talking about something time-wise beyond this particular day of the Lord. We're talking about the results of the day of the Lord. And then verse 9, the Lord, or Yahweh, will be king over the whole earth. On that day, there'll be only one Lord, and his name the only name. And now we go back to chapter 12, when we start seeing the idols being removed, and 13, where you know the prophets aren't going to talk about their idols or their false philosophies. Verse 10, the whole land from Geba to the north, I'll show you that here tonight, I think, in the picture, to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem, will become like the Arabah, or Araba, which means flat. It's going to collapse. And just remember, Geba, I'm going to show you a picture of that, how high it is. It's 5 miles north of Jerusalem. It's the high place. Solomon was at. And to Rimmon in the south, the whole area is going to collapse, and both Micah and Isaiah say Jerusalem will be lifted up. So does Ezekiel. As he talks about the water flowing, the mountain's going to be lifted up. Mount Moriah is going to be lifted up, and everything's going to fall flat with a valley running out of the city. So we're talking about the topography, huge topography change. But Jerusalem will be raised up. So you've got Micah, you've got Isaiah, you've got Zechariah, you've got Ezekiel seeing it. It's going to be raised up. Now, if you want to say, well, figuratively, it's going to be the head of the nations. You can go with that if you want to, but we've got earthquakes making valleys. We've got people running through the valleys. We've got islands disappearing. We've got mountains falling. We've got Israel or Jerusalem being raised up. Let's just stay with the idea that the topography is going to change. And that's we know this from the days of Noah and Peleg, when the earth was divided, the continental plates split apart, the waters of the deep burst forth. Continents are moving, mountains are being formed, but nonetheless, it'd be like a reversal of that. But Jerusalem will be raised up and remain in its place from the Benjamin Gate, now we can go through and identify this, and we will when we get here, to the site of the first gate, to the corner gate. In fact, the last page of your notes, you got a map right here if you want to look at it. That's a map from the days of Nehemiah, which is very, very close to the days of Zechariah here. To the Tower of Hanel, to the royal wine press. It will be inhabited, never again to be destroyed. Jerusalem will be secured. Now, that's all detail about what takes place because of battle. Now, verse 12, we go back to the battle. This is some details. This is the plague with which the Lord, Yahweh, will strike all the nations that fought against Jerusalem. When he comes back, how is he going to attack them? Well, one, their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongue will rot in their mouths. Now, you wonder if that scene in Indiana Jones when they open up the Ark of the Covenant, if they got that from here, because that's exact. When I, ever since I've seen that, I can't, when I read this, I can't do anything but think of that, the Nazi opening up, you know the scene. If I was a contemporary pastor, I'd have the video for you right here that you could all watch, and then I'd, you know. But anyway, we would have to wrap this up in like 12 minutes. We wouldn't have time to do this. Anyway, on that day, men will be stricken by the Lord. Here's the second thing he'll do with great panic. When they see each other rotting, they're going to start just fighting whoever they can fight. Each man will seize the hand of another, and they will attack each other. Now here it is, verse 14. Judah, too, will fight at Jerusalem. So during this battle, Judah is also engaged, and that matches chapter 12, where you've got the Jews fighting, especially after they see who the Lord is. The wealth of all the surrounding nations will be collected. The chapter begins with Jerusalem. Your plunder will be taken from you, but by here, they're now plundering the nations. The armies that have come down, they're plundering their tents. Great quantities of gold and silver and clothing. A similar plague will strike the horses and mules, the camels and donkeys, and the animals of those camps. Again, just to make a point, why are there horses and mules and camels and donkeys there? Is this a figurative way of saying tanks and trucks and helicopters? Or have we, our modern age and technology, gone haywire and we're back to doing this right here, fighting this way? It's possible it could be figurative. But it's also possible this is exactly the way the world ends. We understand the tribulation, this last seventh week, we are in the dark ages. I mean, we're back to the days of, we've rejected the truth. People are believing a lie and deception. There's demonic activity all over. There's been plagues. I mean, there's been so the seals, the trumpets, the bowls. Life is hanging on by a thread. The fact that you can't get reception on your cell phone, you lost that probably, 8 years ago. I paraphrase. Now we go back to what this is going to be like. Then the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. Who gets destroyed here is not everybody in the world. It's the militaries of the nations that have been sent here. Those militaries are destroyed. But they're representing nations of people back home. And some of those people back home didn't want to follow the government. Maybe you can imagine being in a country or a governmental system that the government is doing this, they're heading this direction, and you're like, no, that's not the way we should go. They're starting wars you don't want to be involved in. They're promoting an ideology. You think that's not even the truth. But yet your military, your government officials, everybody looks at your nation. It's like, ah, you're doing this. It's like, that's not me. I'm against it. Well, the same thing here. Many people are not going to have sided with the Antichrist, but they're stuck in nations. Many of them would be believers. Some of them are just, they're about to become believers, or you got to decide how they get into the millennium. And those that survive back in the homeland, their militaries are defeated, their governments have collapsed, but they will come up year after year and celebrate in Jerusalem the Feast of Tabernacles, which is the feast that recognizes the Lord dwelling with Israel in the wilderness. And that's why they celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, because the Lord is dwelling in their earth, and they're required. Again, you talk about being hardcore. This is not like because they're all believers. Now, again, this is another topic, because you know everybody that enters is going to be a believer, but then they're going to begin having children. You know, if you go down that line, you'll have resurrected believers, which is another concept. Are there resurrected people walking around in resurrected body that can transport at the speed of thought? Meanwhile, everybody else, hey, I'll see you there, and you're there because you're a resurrected saint, but your fleshly friends, they've got to, you know, take a boat. You know, will we be separate? Are we going to be like, you know, like we don't see angels? I mean, I don't know. I'm shouldn't even be talking about this because I don't know the answer, and we're not even on that subject. But we've got angels around today, and they're working the plan of God while we're working the plan of God, but we don't interact. In this day, will the resurrected saints be living somewhere else in another dimension on the earth, rulers and authority? Now, yeah, they replace the rulers and authorities. But anyway, these people will have to come worship. And if they don't worship, look at this. Look at this hardcore right here. Remember, it says he'll rule them with a rod of iron, with an iron scepter. If any of the peoples of the earth, meaning your nation in the millennium, do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord Almighty. You do not go up to worship the King, Yahweh Almighty. They will have no rain. It's like, you worship me, he says, or you'll have a drought. If the Egyptian people do not go up and take part, they will have no rain. The Lord will bring on them the plague he inflicts on the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. So, you know, you've got the law of Hammurabi, and you've got certain laws that Congress passes. Well, one of the laws of the king has right here, the king, the Lord Almighty. Okay, if you do not come up to worship, if you do not send representatives at least to worship and pay homage to my dwelling with you on the earth, first you're going to get no rain. But there's also level 2, 3, 4, and there's a list of plagues that are coming your way if the rain doesn't make you change your mind. And if you can, it says, there's a whole list right here. They'll have no rain. The Lord will bring on them the plagues he inflicts on the nations that do not go up to celebrate the feast. It's like, well, that doesn't sound very Christian. Well, that's the Lord ruling with a scepter of iron. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. Again, we're way ahead of the subject here. We're into the millennium. Now you understand, at the end of the 1,000 years, why, when Satan is released, why? I mean, why is he? We're good here. We're good. Let's just stay here. Because, hey, I got an idea. I got to test all the people. I'm going to release Satan. Now, the false prophet and the Antichrist are already in the lake of fire, but Satan's been locked up. And he's released to go out to the nations to have them march on Jerusalem again after 1,000 years. And now, do you think he's going to find anybody that wants to rebel against Yahweh? Yeah, because we don't go worship him. He won't give us any rain. He starts sending plagues. Let's take him out. And so after 1,000 years of the Lord ruling with an iron scepter, it says they're like the sand of the sea. So many people come up to attack Jerusalem and the king. And at that time, fire consumes them out of heaven. It's a whole different battle. That's the, I think, would be the second battle of Gog and Magog, if you want to go with that. But that's just describing, see, that's describing those events. And that's got to be, that's just a harsh, harsh thing that is, you've got to consider. That's the Lord's nature and how he's going to deal with things. On that day, holy to the Lord will be inscribed on the bells of horses and cooking pots in the Lord's house, in the Lord's house will be like the sacred bowls in front of the altar. So in other words, everything will be holy to the Lord. Every pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be holy to the Lord Almighty, and all who come to sacrifice will take some of the pots and cook in them, and on that day there will be no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord Almighty. So in other words, if these people that do come from the nations to worship the Lord, they're coming from all these nations, they are more than welcome to pick up the utensils that say holy to the Lord. They're welcome into the temple. You can worship the Lord right there. You don't have to have a priest and stand in the background. If you're going to come, you can pick up stuff with holy Lord, the stuff that only the priest can handle, you can have. Go ahead. It's like hoo hut. You know, just go ahead and get in line and just start picking up stuff and use all the utensils. And then it ends this crazy verse. It ends, and on that day there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord Almighty. And then we got to talk about what is that? Is that an actual Canaanite? Or some that translate that merchants? It's like some kind of a person. But anyway, there we have that. That's the chapter we're looking at. We're looking at verses 1 through 5 tonight. Let's look page 1 on the notes. And we've read this, pointed out already. Behold, the day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst. And this is the second behold of that oracle that begins in chapter 12, 13, and 14. Behold, or it can be translated, take note. It indicates the beginning of an oracle. And I just write down here what I just already explained to you. This is the second part of it, and I got the words boxed off there in the Hebrew for you to see. Page 2, the second verse. And now this is the Lord, and this matches Revelation 16, where the demons go off and gather the nations at Armageddon, or the Valley of Jezreel, Har-Megiddo. Now they're gathered in Jerusalem. They've been gathered here to engage in a war with Jerusalem. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses plundered, and the women raped. Half the city shall go into exile, but the rest of the people shall not be cut off from the city. I made a mistake on point one. I was looking for three places where Yahweh speaks in chapter 14, and I only found two of them. And Yahweh is speaking. In chapter 12, Zechariah and Yahweh they interact. Like Zechariah will say something, and Yahweh, there's like four or five places where Yahweh speaks. Here, there's only two places he speaks, and that's in verse 2 and 3, where he says, I will gather all the nations. And then in verse 5, and it's at first it doesn't seem like it possibly, but it's the Lord speaking. You will flee by my mountain valley, for it will extend to Azel. You will flee as you fled from the earthquake. And now there's a matter of when does the Lord stop speaking there. But those are two places Yahweh speaks in this chapter. Otherwise, it's detail. Point two, the reference to gather all nations. This is, again, apparently some last-minute punishment for Israel. Before all Israel is saved, this is apparently, you don't have to agree with this, this is me trying to make sense out of it. Because if the Lord is coming, why let half the city be overrun? Why have the women raped, the houses ransacked? I mean, there's dead bodies, there's blood all over the streets, and you're right down here saving the people in Edom, potentially. Why let this get out of hand? Well, it's part of the judgment because of their rebellion. And apparently, remember, this whole 70th week begins with the Jews signing a peace treaty with the Antichrist, who they think is the Messiah. And so this is only, it would be 7 years later, so there's probably still leadership, there's still people, their ideology doesn't match those that are hiding down here. Some of them have stayed. See, Jesus says, when you see the abomination of desecration set up in the temple, flee. Get out of town. He tells, in one of the Gospels, he tells them to flee to the mountains. Another account, because he's talking about this time, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by the nations at this time, he then says, look up, for your salvation draws near. So if you're in this city and you see these nations coming, it's the end of the 70th week, your salvation's coming over the Mount of Olives. Another time he says, when you see it set up, if it's at halfway point, flee, and he'll come back and deliver you here, comes up, and then marches in, and their salvation's coming. Some of those people, they didn't flee. Why didn't they flee? Because they probably sided with the Antichrist. They're not all, I mean, just think of America. You know, everyone's going to make a choice. Not everyone's going to choose the right way. Not everyone's going to have the same ideology. So some of them that signed the peace treaty with the Antichrist, when the abomination is set up, they're like, not that big a deal. We'll stay. And they compromise, maybe receive the mark, and they may be the ones being eliminated in this battle. The text does not say that. I'm trying to make sense out of the fact that Jesus is right here. Save the nation. Save Jerusalem. Not yet. He lets them get taken out into exile. Their houses are plundered. And then he shows up like 2 hours late. I mean, if you would have been here 2 hours earlier, and there's got to be divine discipline going on there, I'm going to say. You don't have to agree with that, but you do have to address that. So top of page 3, the overrunning defeat of Jerusalem is this takes place, A through F. Nations gather against Jerusalem. Nations battle Jerusalem. Nations take the city of, they take the city. Now, there's some that are still fighting and running around in the streets, hiding and protecting themselves. Nations take the city of Jerusalem. Nations plunder the houses of Jerusalem. They're going through, taking all the stuff out. Nations rape the women of Jerusalem. And nations exile half the city of Jerusalem. So half of the people are out of the city. Houses are being ransacked. The women are being raped. The city has fallen. In the news, Jerusalem has fallen. Now, the fighting in the streets is continuing. And that's point 4, the resistance of Jerusalem. The rest of the people, or half of Jerusalem, are not exiled and will not be cut off from Jerusalem. And cut off refers in the Bible, just like in Daniel, the Messiah, the king, is cut off. It means killed. It also is used to just be removed, like cursed and removed from your community. So I guess you could say it could mean dead or exiled. But when it says the rest of the people will not be, they're not just sitting in their living rooms, you know, watching the news on television. They're probably hiding, they're resisting. There's some kind of, again, resistant force, maybe even fighting in the streets. They're fighting, and that may be what chapter 12 is talking about when it talks about there's three groups of people that are fighting, if it be Levi and David and Judah, and they're all fighting. They may be the ones that are recognizing the Messiah, who is down here in Judah, or not in Judah, but in Edom, delivering some people. Okay. I put a question mark there. 4B question mark. Half the people in Jerusalem fighting in this battle are strong enough to prevent their houses from being plundered, their women from being raped, and they and their people from going into exile. They're standing firm, and that's what you see in chapter 12, Israel fighting, and the people saying, the Lord is making them strong, the Lord is making them strong, because they haven't compromised. And in just a moment, they're supposed to look up, Matthew says, look up because your salvation draws near, and it does, coming right over the Mount of Olives, there's the Lord coming back, and their salvation is in town. Chapter 14, verse 3, then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as when he fights on the day of battle. Now, this whole idea of him marching from Edom and coming up, that is not being said in these verses. You understand? I've combined that. So he's now, at that point, half the city's taken, half the city's fighting, the nations are here. I think they've taken the city and moved on down to attack the people down south. It doesn't say that. But it does say in chapter 12, the people are fighting and starting driving them back. Now, either coming out of heaven, the second coming, coming out of heaven, or coming up over the Mount of Olives, Jesus is on the Mount of Olives. The Messiah is on the Mount of Olives, and it splits. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights on the day of battle. On that day, and when it says fights on the day of battle, that is talking about a theophany. You're going to start seeing things like earthquakes, lightning, thunders, waters, mountains disappearing, islands disappearing. You've got a theophany. You've got the divine warrior showing up right here, and that's what described. And now with that idea, you can start connecting verses in Isaiah and Micah and Revelation. It talks about the islands disappearing, the mountains falling, a great earthquake, the city being divided in three parts. It's like, that correlates with this event. They don't all have to be separate events. They don't all have to be the same one. But because you have a very unique theophany, the second coming, the divine warrior showing up, you can consider putting all those verses together, and now you start getting a clear, more interesting picture instead of just some random thoughts. On that day, his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east. Now, it's interesting that they're identifying where it's at. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west by a very wide valley, so that one half the mountain shall move north and the other half will move southward, creating a valley. If you don't mind, I'm going to bore you with this just so you can see it. Page 4. This is the Lord standing on... I got a great map here. What does this even mean? Here is the Jerusalem. Here is the Mount of Olives right there. Jesus is on the Mount of Olives. If he's landed, like he ascended... See, that's not... I've always taught that. It's just I'm thinking maybe different. In Acts, he was on the Mount of Olives and ascended from the Mount of Olives, and the angels looked at the men from Galilee and says, the same Jesus will come back the same way he left. Okay, same way, it doesn't say same place. Now, I've always read that, same way, same place. He went up from the Mount of Olives, he's going to come back the same way, same place. And there you have it. But it doesn't say the same place. He could, because he's down here and he's marching this way, he's either going to come back here, then he's got to go down here and come back up here. You could do that too, but get some verses. But nonetheless, being here, he's going to go from here and go into the city. Now, I just wanted to show you this. Ezekiel 11:23, that's the verse underlined in point 1a. But I've got sections from chapter 9 of Ezekiel, verse 3, up through chapter 11, verse 24. Because Ezekiel is going to, as you know, chapter 9 through 11, here's a close-up. Here's the Temple Mount. Here's the temple. And here's the Mount of Olives. There's an east gate of the wall of the city. There's an east entrance here. And back in here is the most holy place. He is going to see the glory of the Lord rise up from between the cherubim and move to the front door, the front of the temple, and be out here over the threshold of the temple gate behind the altar of burnt offering. And then the Lord is going to move over here to the east gate entrance and give some directions and some words to Ezekiel. And then he's going to move this way over the Mount of Olives and go to Chaldea or Babylon. And that's where Ezekiel's going to see over here. He's going to see the same presence of the Lord over here. Is at that point, the glory of the Lord has left the temple. Now, you've got to decide. You have a very clear, there's no way, you know, in the wilderness when God entered the tabernacle, because the priests saw it, the people saw it, it's recorded. Solomon builds the temple, it's very clear the day the Lord enters the temple. The priests had to stop, the glory of God entered the temple. And he was there from Solomon's day all the way up until this day in Ezekiel, when Ezekiel sees this. And you've got a very clear discussion of him leaving. Now, these people are going to come back from exile. They're going to start talking about building the temple in, you know, 520. They're not going to get it done, or 538. They're going to have permission from Cyrus. In fact, Cyrus is paying for it. It's funded by the Persians. Build the temple. But the Samaritans caused problems. It's difficult. It's too much work. It's like, oh, well, and they just gave up. Well, 520, that's where we're at right now. Haggai, Zechariah, and Ezra are going to start, well, Haggai and Zechariah are going to start prophesying, and that's going to fire the people up, and they're going to have the temple built by 516. So the temple is rebuilt. But they don't have, I don't know of a reference where all of a sudden it got, you know, the cloud came and the priests couldn't work and fire was consuming. It was like they built a shell. Herod is going to dismantle it piece by piece and rebuild it more gloriously. Now, you've got the temple in Jesus' day. When Jesus dies, the curtain is torn from top to bottom. Is that the presence of God leaving the temple? So, I mean, what's happening right there? He's making the way obvious. Now, listen. In 63 BC, Pompey, the Roman general, came in And he wants to see this. Everybody talk about the Jerusalem temple. He wants to see it. So he goes in. Now you try this in the Old Testament. Pompey walks up here. Now when Alexander the Great came to worship, we talk about that, he worshiped in the court of the Gentiles. He followed the law, the ritual. He stayed outside. But Pompey is like, whatever, I'm a Roman. He goes in here, looks back, walks back, pulls back the curtain in the holy place. I mean, he's like, you're going to die. He goes in, pulls back the curtain. What? You don't even have a God. There's nothing here. Well, we lost the ark. What? You lost? What? Where's your God? Because he's Roman. You have a representation. And he goes, that was stupid. This is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. At least have some gold back here. Well, nothing happened to him. Now, even the king Uzziah, Azariah, he decided he was going to go back and he was going to just, he wanted to be a priest and burn some incense. And he got too close to the incense and he got leprosy. You don't just go in here. Well, you saw Raiders of the Lost Ark. The guy touched the ark. You saw what happened. Okay, that's not biblical. But it's funny, though. So it is possible, I'm just presenting this, that God wasn't in the temple. The closest you had to the temple was, and a prophet said it, with the Lord will show up in his temple, was Jesus showing up. And then he leaves his temple because they didn't want him. He rides in on the donkey. He came to his temple. He talked in his temple. He taught in his temple. They rejected him. And he doesn't show up again. And this is the return of the glory right here in Zechariah 14. And it's right here on your notes on page 4. This is Ezekiel 11:23 is what I'm looking at. You can read all the way through it, what I told you. This is chapter 9. Verse 3 through chapter 11, verse 24, that's the Lord leaving. And I've got the underlying part there, point A. And the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood on the mountain that is on the east side of the city. And the Spirit lifted me, Ezekiel, up and brought me in a vision by the Spirit of God into Chaldea with the exiles. And you can read all the way through that and all the details there. That is God clearly leaving the temple. Now, Ezekiel 43 is talking about the days before the millennium. And this is talking about the days the glory returns to the temple. And I think Ezekiel 43 verses 1 through 5 are parallel to these verses of chapter 14 when the Lord stands on the Mount of Olives, just like he was on the Mount of Olives and leaving in Ezekiel. He's on the Mount of Olives and is going to enter his temple here in Ezekiel 14, but also Zechariah 14, Ezekiel 43, 1 through 5. Then he led me to the gate facing east. That's the eastern gate right here. And this is now, even this is in the future, even in our future. And behold, the glory of God of Israel was coming from the east. Now again, coming from the east. If I wanted to jump on that and support my idea, here is the march from Edom up here, coming this way, coming through Jericho, just like Jesus did on before the triumphal. He's coming from the east into Jerusalem, not coming down on the Mount of Olives. Now, I'm not trying to start an argument, because if you read Acts, it's like he left the Mount of Olives, he's going to come down on the Mount of Olives. But if you've got this Edom situation, the Lord is marching, striding forward in glory, having defeated the nations, he's going to be coming from the east somehow, either up this way and into the east. But this would mean he is, right here, the glory of God of Israel, this would be the Messiah, this would be Jesus, was coming from the east. And the sound of his coming was like the sound of many waters. This again is the divine warrior. This is the theophany. And the earth shone with his glory. And the vision I saw, now this is giving you a little more detail about, and his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. This is it. And the vision I saw was just like the vision I had seen when he came to destroy the city. He says, this was just what I saw back in chapter 11, except reverse. And just like the vision that I had seen at the Kibar Canal. And I fell on my face as the glory of the Lord entered the temple by the gate facing east. So he comes from the east, comes through the eastern gate, just like, that's why they've got it blocked shut. You know this. It's blocked shut because they don't want any political figure coming in that gate. I could tell you stories. I want to talk about World War I, but I'm going to move on. But he comes in the eastern gate and goes into his temple, and that's where the water begins to flow. what time is it getting to be? I've got to wrap this up. I'm going to wrap it up. Let me read Isaiah 40, verse 1 through 5. I got so many verses I want to go through tonight. Isaiah 40, verse 1 through 5. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned. This would be them seeing the one they pierced. The war is over. That she has received from the Lord's hand, Yahweh's hand, double for her sins. A voice cries, in the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord. Now we know this is John the Baptist, prepare the way for the Lord, because Jesus' ministry, he's the forerunner. But Jesus is also the one who's going to come in glory, and he's coming, well, it says right here, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. That would be, he's coming this way, or coming this way, coming, make straight a highway. The Lord is coming. He's coming on a highway. Every valley shall be lifted up, every mountain and hill will be made low, and that matches Revelation, that matches the prophecies in Isaiah, the return of the Lord. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. Now, John the Baptist was to do that to prepare Jesus for his ministry. He wasn't changing topography. And in fact, as we went through Mark, John's fate as the messenger was the same fate that the Messiah was going to receive. John came proclaiming the message of the Messiah. They killed him. And Jesus knew, well, the fate of the messenger is the fate of the guy that he's introducing. Well, this time, the Lord is going to be coming, and as may be. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. That's this right now. Watch. That's what's happening right here. They're going to see the glory of the Lord, the one they pierced, and they'll mourn. And all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. So I think you can tie those together. Right here, to wrap this up, because I did it, you're going to look at it. Page 5. This is the Mount of Olives. And right here, if this is Jerusalem right here, we're standing, if this is the Temple Mount today, if this makes sense to you, we're standing in the old city of David, actually at David's palace, the location of David's palace right here. And I'm looking this way over the Kidron Valley at the Mount of Olives. You can see it. And there's three summits right there. There's three. You see the three summits of the Mount of Olives. That is where Jesus is going to come, land on, or come over. He definitely came over that on Palm Sunday. He came because Bethany, you see where it says third summit? Bethany is just on the other side of that. I wanted to walk to Bethany. My plan, when I went to Israel, I was going to walk to Bethany. I wanted it because the Lazarus tomb is there. But I was getting some information, and the problem with that is, it's a Palestinian village, so there's a wall built, so you can't just walk to it. You can walk. I walked all kinds of places, but when it got to there, you would it was like a half-hour drive. It would take a taxi, and you had to drive up, go through the checkpoint, and come down and around. But Bethany is just on the other side, where it says third summit. It's just on the other side of the hill. So when Jesus came in for Palm Sunday, that's where he's coming from. Okay, that's the Mount of Olives, and if this happens historically, that's where these events are going to take place. The next picture is interesting, and I referred to it earlier tonight. The next picture is I'm standing on the Mount of Olives, looking down, and you can see the Eastern Gate. That's the little part sticking out right there. That's the Eastern Gate. But the main point that I want to point out here is you see where it says Nabi Samuel? That's I got a line pointing there. That's the high place of Gibeon. That is where supposedly Nabi Samuel, that means Nabi means prophet, Samuel means Samuel, the prophet Samuel. That's where his tomb is supposedly at. I don't know how real it is. The Crusaders got excited about it. If the Crusaders got excited about it, it probably means it's not right. But nonetheless, that is the high place. That's where the ark was. The ark was for a while after the tabernacle got destroyed. That's where Solomon went and offered all the sacrifice before the temple was built. And that's where the Lord talked to him, you know, ask me for anything. He asks for wisdom. That's the high place. It is exactly 5 miles from Nabi Samuel, or the high place of Gibeon, to Jerusalem. So that's 5 miles away. The next picture, you can see Tony standing there looking down. And now you can see the southeast corner. That's this corner right here of the Temple Mount. And you can see the Eastern Gate in the middle. And she's looking over all the Jewish tombs. graves. That third summit is covered with Jewish graves, not the all of the Mount of Olives. And of course, that's where they want to be buried because that's where their Messiah is going to come to. Isn't that amazing? Jesus, our Messiah, and the Jewish Messiah, we all read the same scriptures and we're all thinking the same thing. We just got different people. Okay, the next picture is from the Garden of Gethsemane, but I'm down further down the Mount of Olives, and you can see I'm almost in the Kidron Valley, and I'm looking up at the Eastern Gate. That Eastern Gate, I'd love to spend some time on that, but that Eastern Gate is a Byzantine, probably built, 400-500 A.D. right there, and then they used to open it up for Palm Sunday, go in and out, but then when the Muslims got control, they blocked it, but that is not the gate of the New Testament, nor the Old Testament. But underneath that gate is, but no one will let it be, the Islam, the Muslims, those that control it won't let it be excavated. They got graves on it, so you can't mess with it. If you would excavate, now if you look in my Jerusalem book and you look at the North Gate, the Damascus Gate, you've got the 1500 glorious Damascus Gate. It's got the couple entrances, you've got the places for the archers, you've got the places to dump out the hot oil, you've got all those things. But it's a bridge. You got to walk on a bridge to get to it because they excavated underneath the Damascus Gate. And underneath the Damascus Gate is the first century gate. I went down there. You could go down there. I walked on the pavement from the first century because it's underneath the Damascus Gate. You couldn't see it for years until they said, we're going to excavate. So they supported it, went down, and they found the gate that Herod Agrippa had built. The citizen, where you walk in as a citizen, a person, a postern gate is where a people just walk in. Then they got the main gate that you could go in with your horses and chariots and wagons, but it's right directly underneath. And there is a gate underneath there. They know this because one, it would make sense, but also there before those graves were there. Sometime it was in the 70s or the 80s, maybe probably the 70s. A guy was out taking pictures, kind of like I do. I'd go in places I shouldn't go, got in trouble a couple times, but hey, you gotta risk it for the biscuit. One time I got scared. I thought I was going to have more than just risk it for the biscuit. I thought they were going to take me in. But, you got to do what you do. He was out taking pictures, and it was raining. I can always remember his name, James Fleming. I think his name was James Fleming. And the ground broke away because of the rain, and there's graves there, and he could see down underneath the ground level of the wall, and he took some pictures. And you could see the top arch of an ancient gate below this, and then there's a bunch of bones there because there's graves in front of it. And of course, soon as he publishes it and they talk about it, I went over there, of course, I couldn't see anything. There's other place there, and they've just got concrete poured over it. There's all kind of just covering it up because they don't want you to see these things. No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I could go on about that. But that Eastern Gate, that is not the Eastern Gate of Jesus' day, but it is a gate on top of the first century, and potentially they would have rebuilt it right in the same place of Solomon's. So again, now which gate he goes in, if that gate's going to survive the 70th week, if it's going to survive 200 years, all it takes is one war. Like you go to the Zion Gate on the south side, there's bullet holes in it from the earlier wars. It's all chipped up. Okay, the bottom picture, you're looking from the south. I'm down here, went outside of town down here and took a picture of going up this way. And you can see the Kidron Valley. And that Kidron Valley is kind of going to run down, and that would probably be where the Valley of Jehoshaphat, where the Lord judges, would be in that area. You can see the Mount of Olives. Now, here, this is useful because, Mount Moriah, Mount of Olives, do you see the mountains? It's like, it looks like Western Hills, my neighborhood, They're just higher places. It is bedrock, but again, they're more like high mounds or something. Okay, and then on the back page, of course, that's the map of Jerusalem in Nehemiah's day. And you can see the Temple Mount to get a bearing. That would be the Temple Mount or Mount Moriah. And the sheep's pool would be the Pool of Bethesda today. And then the Gihon Springs right there, that would be where David's palace would have been, right above that in that area. And then the Pool of Siloam. See what's happening at the Pool of Siloam? They're excavating. They found it in 2004, the original, the actual Pool of Siloam. They've now bought the property because it's a huge pool. All you could see was the south side. I've got some pictures in my book, of course. But now they've bought the land and they're excavating the whole thing. And I'm not sure what's going to turn up. Okay, I've got to quit. I appreciate you listening. We'll talk more about this. I'd love to go through some more of those verses I've got written down right there. I was planning on doing that, but obviously I have no sense of time and no ability to judge. So I'll pray, and we are free to go. My wife's ready to go. There she's waving at me. Father, we do thank you for the Word of God. We thank you for the truth, the hope that you present to us. We do ask that we would have a great faith, have confidence in you, that we would live a life that is pleasing to you, that we would, in this age, stand for the truth, that we would understand and know what the truth is and be able to lead others to your truth, to your light, to your righteousness. Again, we thank you for this opportunity to live at this time and know that you have prepared us to do the work you've called us to. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.